So that's the second phase. Then the third phase has to do with your mind, with your state of consciousness. And this has to do with what we would ordinarily call meditation. The seventh and eighth aspects of the path are called Samyak Smriti and Samyak Samadhi. Smriti means recollection. That's the best English word for it. Now, do you understand? The word recollect is to gather together what has been scattered. What is the opposite of remember? Obviously, dismember. What has been chopped up and scattered becomes remembered. So in the Christian scheme, do this in remembrance of me. You see, the Christ has been sacrificed, chopped up. But the Mass is celebrated in remembrance. One of the old liturgies says the wheat which has been scattered all over the hills and grows up is gathered again into the bread. Remembered. Go back to your Hindu basis. The world is regarded as the dismemberment of the self, the Brahman, the Godhead. The one is dismembered into the many. So remembrance is realizing again that each single member of the many is really the one. So that's recollection. You can think of it too in another way, and it's really the same way if you think it through. I'm going to leave you with a few puzzles so that you can think them through and I won't explain them. But another way is to be recollected is to be completely here and now. Are you here and now? Are you really here? There was a wise old boy who used to give lectures on these things, and he would get up and not say a word. He would just look at the audience. And he'd examine every person individually. And they'd all start feeling uncomfortable. He wouldn't say anything. He'd look at them all. And then he'd suddenly say, "Wake up! You're all asleep. And if you don't wake up, I won't give you any lecture." Are you here, recollected? See, most people aren't. They're bothering about yesterday and wondering what they're going to do tomorrow. And aren't all here. That's a definition of sanity, to be all there. So to be recollected is to be completely alert, available for the present. Because that's the only place that you are ever going to be in. Yesterday doesn't exist. Tomorrow never comes. There is only today. A great Sanskrit invocation says, "Look to this day, for it is life. In its brief course lie all the realities of our existence. Yesterday is but a memory. Tomorrow is only a vision. Look well then to this day. Such is the salutation of the dawn." So, Smriti means then recollectedness in the sense of being all here. In the sense that this is the only where there is. Then beyond that comes Samadhi. Again, notice the presence of this word S-A-M, Sam. Samadhi is integrated consciousness in which there is no further separation between the knower and the known, the subject and the object. You are what you know. Now we think, in the ordinary way, that we are the witnesses of a constantly changing panorama of experience, from which we as the knowers of this, in a way, stand aside and watch it. We think of our minds as a kind of tablet upon which experience writes a record. And the tablet is always there, although the experience goes by. And eventually the experience, by writing so much on the tablet, wears it out. It's all scratched away, and you die, see? But actually, if you will investigate this, and you have to experiment on this, because I cannot explain it to you in words, you can only find it out for yourself. There is no difference between the knower and the known. When you say, I see a sight, I feel a feeling, you are using redundant language. I see implies the sight. I feel implies the feeling. Do you hear sounds? No. You just hear. Or you can say, there are sounds. Either one will do. So you will find, if you thoroughly investigate the process of experiencing, that the experiencing is the same as the experiencer. And this is the state of samadhi. I put it originally in this form, that the organism and the environment are a single behavioral process. So, likewise, is the knower and the known. So, you as someone who is aware, and all that you are aware of is one process. That is the state of samadhi. And you get to that state by the practice of meditation. Every Buddha figure practically is seen in the sitting posture of meditation, which is sitting down quietly and being aware of all that goes on without comment, without thinking about it. And when you stop categorizing, verbalizing, talking to yourself inside your head, naturally the separations between, for example, knower and known, self and other, simply vanish. Can you point to the difference between my five fingers? It just isn't there in the physical world. Of course, that's not saying that the fingers are joined like a duck's claws with a web, but that it's just that. They're not the same. That's an idea. They're not different. That's an idea. And these ideas just aren't here. See? You can't point to it. You can't put your finger on it. Get then to the state of affairs where you see the world free from concepts. That's what Buddhists mean by void. When they say the world is basically, they use the phrase shunya, that has a meaning of empty, void. Everything is shunya. This has certainly also the meaning of anicca, of transience, but basically it means you can't catch the world in a conceptual net. Just if you try to catch water in a net, it all slips through. If you try to tie up water in a paper package or grab it in your hands, it all flows through. So shunya, it doesn't really mean that the world itself, that the energy of the world is nothing at all. It means that no concept of it is valid. You cannot make any one idea or belief or doctrine or system or theory tie the thing up. And they have then this method. You must understand, of course, that Buddhism is a method, not a doctrine. And the method is a dialogue. What appear that I've given you already now is not the teaching of Buddhism. Buddhism has no teaching. These are the opening gambits in a dialogue. It goes like this. There's a teacher. And incidentally, the teacher is appointed by the student. There are no teachers without students. It's the patient makes the doctor. And you, on your authority, and from reasons known to yourself, you pick on some individual who you think is wiser than you are, and you take your problems to him. Actually, it's your idea that he's wiser than you are, your opinion, your judgment. And you say to him, I suffer, and I don't want to suffer. And the teacher comes back saying, isn't it obvious that you suffer because you desire, because you cling? Try not to cling. And you go away, and you try not to cling. And you find it's rather difficult. And then it comes to you, through various suggestions that the teacher has handed out, that you are desiring not to desire. That your very effort not to cling is a kind of clinging. And you go back and say to the teacher, well, now what? I don't see what I'm to do. So he says, well, see if you can stop desiring not to desire. And you find yourself in a very sticky situation. Because you've realized that this is a situation where you can't do anything about it, because anything you do about it will be wrong. And furthermore, it's a situation you can't do nothing about, because doing nothing about it will be a kind of inverse way of trying to do something about it. Like a clever woman, when she really wants to get a man, will pretend to run away from him. So the dialogue between the teacher and the student goes like that. It gets you into this hopeless situation where you can't do nothing and you can't do something. It also involves the teacher of a Buddhist method destroys all your beliefs. Anything you propose in a verbal or intellectual way as a kind of answer to the life problem that you have, he will show you it's full of holes. Every conceivable theory will be destroyed. That's shunya. And people get very nervous when this happens. You might think it was merely an intellectual discussion, but the emotions start flying when the teacher begins to demolish everything. Well, they say, after he's argued you out of every position you can take, they say, well, what do you believe in? What would you propose as a constructive answer? He doesn't say anything. But they look at him again, they see he's not out of his mind. He seems to be all right. But that's the method, you see, to get rid of all your intellectual hang-ups, all your ideas, metaphysical ideas, philosophical ideas. It goes beyond that. The idea of who you are, what your role is, all that is shown to be a mere facade. It's like teaching a person to swim by just kicking him into the water. It's dangerous, too. A lot of people go crazy when all their props are taken out from under them. But if you are willing to try to take the risk, it's the best way. I call it spiritual window cleaning. Because if you paint a picture of the sun on the glass, may be very pretty, but it'll block your vision of the true sun. So you have to scrape it off. And so in the same way, all our ideas of God, of the afterlife, of who we ought to be, are paintings on the glass. And they have to be scraped off. So, going on then to what comes out of this. If you go through this and you get completely blown out and released and are in the state of nirvana, for no reason that anybody can explain, just as, for example, as I pointed out, when you see that you can't change yourself, you can't lift yourself up by your own bootstraps, you then get a new access of psychic energy. So in exactly the same way, when you get to the state of nirvana, there wells up from within you what the Buddhists call karuna or compassion. The sense that you aren't different from everybody else. Everybody else's suffering is your suffering. And so this tremendous sense of solidarity with all other beings arises. So that he who reaches nirvana doesn't, as it were, withdraw into a sort of isolated peace, but is always coming back into the world, into the difficulties, into the problems of life, in compassion for everyone else. You can't be saved alone, because you're not alone. You are the whole cosmos.
Sounds True presents Leave It Be, Session 4, on Taoism with Alan Watts.
I'm going to talk to you about Taoism, which is one of the principal forms of Chinese philosophy, as it were, the opposite number of Confucianism. For these two ways of thought lie at the roots of Chinese civilization, both of them having a kind of common origin in the attitude to life expressed in the Book of Changes, or the I Ching, which may be as early as about 1300 BC. It's a very strange book. It is a commentary on 64 symbols, which are made up of broken and unbroken lines. The unbroken line like this, and the broken line like this. And this unbroken line is called yang, yang. And the broken line is called yin. And this is ostensibly a method of decision making. When you flip a coin to make a decision, you've only got two choices. It's either heads or tails. But imagine having a 64-sided coin to flip to help you make decisions. It's rather an interesting idea, because when we do make decisions, we are always eventually reduced to flipping a coin. However well you think it through, you don't have time enough to think it all the way through. You know that there are always possibilities that you didn't take into consideration or couldn't take into consideration. And although you plan and wonder and work out the data, it eventually comes down to the point where you flip a coin, because you've got to make up your mind. But in some respects, you see, a 64-sided coin would be more suggestive, shall we say, than a two-sided coin.